Yes, we're thrilled to have you, and we also welcome several guests who are not part of the seminar. But Jane, you may recall from your visit 3 years ago, 2 years ago, that on such Wednesdays when we have a visiting speaker, we try to extend a public invitation. So we welcome you. This is our next to last class. I can't believe how quickly the semester is going along. When do you all finish at Occidental?
We finish right before Thanksgiving. Is that so? It's the same for you then?
Yeah, this class, because it's meeting on Wednesday, has its last class meeting next Wednesday. I think the last class period is the Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. So thanks again. And I am just really excited to introduce you. I'd just like to say a few words about Professor Hong and then let her take over and share with us her work on trying to think and imagine the civil rights movement in a larger kind of context, but also to help us enlarge the narrative and thinking, for example, about how such a campaign as that to end Japanese internment camps both belongs in, historically because of real institutional connections, but also thematically, this civil rights movement that we've been together kind of trying to rethink and reimagine this semester. And it's just been a lovely journey. I was initially worried, Jane, that a class like the Civil Rights Seminar, which is one of my favorite courses, as a virtual course would be diminished in, obvious ways. But in fact, it hasn't. And I think part of it is a tribute to these terrific students. Also to Dr. May, who has not only virtually held my hand through the technology, but just done incredible work to make this seminar just kind of pop. And the weekly contributions that the students are making on their readings, I think points both to their own, their own excellence, but also to how powerful the story is and these ideas are in the current context. So you should know that Professor Hong is currently a historian of assistant professor or associate professor at Occidental College in Los Angeles, and a historian of U.S. immigration and engagement with the world, with a focus on Asia after World War II. I just want to say a couple things about Jane here. Professor Hong's first book, which appeared last year, Opening the Gates to Asia, A Trans-Pacific History of How America Repealed Asian Exclusion, situates the transnational movement to repeal America's Asian exclusion laws in the context of Black civil rights struggles at home and U.S. military intervention in the decolonizing Asia. It argues that repeal was part of the price of America's post-war empire in Asia. Even as the U.S. expanded its power over Asian peoples, the demands of building and sustaining this imperial reach compelled U.S. officials to respond to the anti-racist and anti-colonial demands of non-white peoples, if only in the most symbolic and performative ways. A multi-archival study, the book draws upon research conducted in the U.S., India, and the Philippines. And as I understand it, was a revision, whether it was a deep revision or I don't know, of your doctoral dissertation at Harvard. Jane was an undergraduate at Yale and did an MA and was history at Brown University, and then her PhD at Harvard in covering, I guess, approximately half of all the Ivy League schools in that brilliant intellectual. Professor Hong's current book project that I'm terribly excited about, I'll just say briefly, is uses the history of Asian American evangelicals as a lens to explore the intersections of race, religion, and partisanship since the 1970s. And this this book would be and will be the first major history of Asian American evangelicals. And perhaps there will be time for some consideration of that. I love this final passage, though, from your homepage at Occidental, which I'll read and then turn things over to you. Hong is committed to making U.S. history scholarship accessible outside the college classroom. A former high school teacher, she has led immigration-themed workshops and seminars for the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. In June 2018, she worked with 33 California public school teachers as lead instructor for a GLI seminar titled U.S. Immigration Through a California Lens. She has written for news outlets such as the LA Times and consulted for television shows, including Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates, which is a fabulous show. I haven't seen the one with you, but I'm going to put it on my to-be-watched list. And American Idol. Okay, that's a story you've got to talk about. I thought I had like just really, you know, shown your celebrity status by, you know, the afternoon when Alec Baldwin visited your class on 20th century history. So mind blown on that. Most recently, she was featured in episodes 2 and 3 of the PBS docuseries Asian Americans, which the New York Times called the most ambitious documentary project ever to chronicle the history of the Asian American community. She currently serves on the executive board of the Immigration and Ethnic History Society, which promotes the study of the history of immigration to the U.S. and Canada from all parts of the world. It's my great honor to welcome Professor Hong here, to count her as a friend, and simply to affirm what seems obvious even now, that she's kind of a rock star. So we're really fortunate to have you here today.
Thank you so much for that. I mean, incredibly kind and generous introduction. The American Idol piece was many years ago, and I did a phone call. This is the first iteration of American Idol. So probably before most of your students' time, most of you are like, what's American Idol? But there's a reboot that some of you might watch, but yeah, that was a very interesting experience. It can be nice to live in LA close to where the action is. So I'll chalk it up to that. But thanks so much for having me. And I had a good experience, such a good experience 3 years ago talking to a previous iteration of this course. And I'm just really excited to share some thoughts with you today. So I know it's your second to last class. I just taught my class like literally 30 minutes ago. So I know how tricky it could be at the end of the semester. So I'm going to try to keep it moving and then leave some time for Q&A and discussion at the end as well, because I'm very curious to hear your thoughts. And I hope that some of what I say will generate some thoughts on your part. Can everyone see this, the PowerPoint? Excellent. Okay, so I'm gonna talk about Asian Americans and where they fit into US civil rights histories. And you know, some of this might cover or touch on themes that you've talked about over the course of the semester. And I just hope that I can relate some of my research to what you've been thinking about for many weeks by this point, and which is so relevant in our world today. So I thought I would start off with a recent event. So, I mean, we're familiar with what happened with George Floyd back in May of this year. And a lot of the media coverage surrounding the police officer, there are several police officers who are involved. Derek Chauvin, there in the middle, is probably the one that people know best. And in the conversation around George Floyd with the Black Lives Matter movement, many people talking about this as, you know, our modern day civil rights movement. I mean, these efforts, these campaigns, right, they're not, the struggle's not over, right, is what I think many Americans would agree. And many Americans were introduced to some of these themes for the first time, these questions, perhaps. But there was another kind of conversation happening among scholars who study Asian America, immigration in general, and also among the Asian American community. And I think, you know, I think for today you read a piece from Frank Wu's Yellow, and I think that piece does a really good job of complicating just the very category of Asian American. And that piece was written, I think, in 2002, so almost 20 years ago, but a lot of the things that he talks about are still, I think, still relevant. But if anything, that category Asian American has become even more complex as you have Southeast Asian Americans, refugee histories, right, that are also part of what we kind of call Asian American. So the category itself has become even more contested, I would say, and complicated. And so that really kind of came to light during the conversation around the George Floyd murder, around Derek Chauvin. So Derek Chauvin in the middle. And there are two ways it became, I think, part of the big conversation among Asian American scholars and Asian Americans and folks who care about Asian America. If you look on the bottom right, so there are two ways. The first is there were other police officers in Minneapolis who were involved, right, who were complicit in George Floyd's death. And there you have, right, this image circulated in a lot of places. You have a Hmong American named Tu Tao, you know, Hmong American born and raised, I think, in the Midwest, police officer who kind of stood guard and prevented bystanders who wanted to get involved, who wanted to intervene on George Floyd's behalf. Tu Tao was one of the police officers who made it impossible, kind of prevented folks from intervening. And, you know, there have been some news stories about him. Actually, there are a number of stories about him. And some of the articles kind of delved into Hmong Americans, and Hmong Americans, H-M-O-N-G, right? And for some Americans, especially outside the Midwest, where there aren't large Hmong American populations, I mean, some Americans have never heard of this group before. Some of this news coverage delved into the Hmong American experience, which, I mean, is very different in many ways from the ways that kind of the model minority trope that you read about for today talks about Asian Americans, right? So the model minority trope, right, that you read about, kind of Asian Americans as this very industrious, hardworking, quiet success story that like other groups should strive to be like, right? But when you, who make more than the average American, right? Who kind of educational attainment is higher than the average American, income, et cetera, everything that you would think of as kind of middle-class professional success, right? The idea was Asian Americans are this model minority. So if anything, right, they don't need help. And we can talk more about that idea later. But if you actually look at Hmong Americans, so I'll highlight here Tu Tao on the bottom left. And actually Derek Chauvin, he was married to a Hmong American. So on the left, so the bottom right and then left is his now, I believe they're in the process of getting a divorce, Kelly Mae Tao, no relation. Also Hmong American, and there's a lot of coverage of her. She's a beauty queen from Minnesota. And it's just really interesting to think about kind of where Asian Americans and particularly Hmong Americans fit into this whole story. Because what I saw from my perspective, I saw a lot of, I actually saw a lot of think pieces and stories written by Asian Americans who were really coming to grips with their own complicity in kind of white supremacy, right? And thinking about kind of where Asian Americans fit into this black, this story that's often framed as black and white. Right, because Derek Chauvin, right, George Floyd, but then where do people like Tu Tao fit, right? So it kind of highlighted a lot of, I think, it highlighted the very ambivalent racial space that Asian Americans continue to occupy, I think, even today, right, many, many decades after people have talked about this, right? The New York Times news piece that I think you read for today about the model minority, that's from 1966, right? That's 54 years ago, right? But what's really interesting about the model minority is how enduring it is, right? And how kind of the very ambiguity, the ambivalent racial space that Asian Americans occupy, how that's still a thing, right? There still seems to be a lot of ambivalence. And then within Asian American communities, thinking about Southeast Asian Americans, South Asians, where they fit into this category of Asian American, which I'll talk a little bit about based on my research. Right? The category Asian American refers to many groups, not just Japanese Americans or Chinese Americans. in theory, it does encompass Hmong Americans, but some of the pieces that I saw, right, talked about, right, if you actually look at Hmong Americans as a group, they have a whole different history. And, you know, they're refugees to begin with, but they're not even refugees in the same way that Vietnamese Americans and Cambodian Americans are refugees, because they have a particular story. Hmong Americans, so Hmong, they were a people group in Laos who worked with the U.S. military. They worked with the CIA during the Vietnam War. So they had a very, they had a special relationship with the U.S. military and with the U.S. government. And so that's why many of them were able to gain refugee status, and they were able to come to the U.S. after the United States lost the Vietnam War, right? So even within refugee histories, their history is actually quite distinct. And if you take a look here, there's a group out of UC Riverside that does a lot of good work disaggregating the term Asian American. And I think there's been a lot of stuff. I mean, many of you probably have seen, there's so many news articles right now disaggregating Latino American, right? Because the Latino vote, right, in this last week's election has been so important. You can argue that there's a very similar, right, problematizing, right, that needs to happen with this category of Asian American, because it's such a diverse category. If you take a look here, even just median household income, this is from 2014. Hmong are actually second to last, 52,500 a year. That's actually lower than the average median, so the median household income for white Americans, right? So there is really vast disparities in the groups that together people still all continue to refer to as Asian American. And the last thing I'll say about problematizing that category is it's been interesting to see kind of discussion around Kamala Harris, who is the first, right, woman of color to become vice president-elect of the United States. That is a major historic moment. What's interesting is thinking about kind of who, what communities can claim her as one of their own, and just how she's talked about. She's claimed by many African-Americans, Black Americans in this country. There's also an interesting conversation there because she, her father was Caribbean, right, Afro-Caribbean. But among Asian Americans, I do see a lot of East Asian Americans claiming her as Asian American, but then I see some pushback among South Asian Americans, right? So there's always this very interesting kind of dynamic even within the community, right? Do South Asians consider themselves Asian American in the same way that maybe Chinese Americans do? Do Vietnamese Americans consider themselves Asian American, right, in the way that maybe Japanese Americans do? So there's really, there's so many different community histories that just get kind of lumped together. And I think that's true for any category, any racial category. But with Asian Americans, I wanted to talk a little bit about that today because I think it's relevant, very relevant to the conversation about Asian America generally, and then particularly what's happening right now in this country. So what I'll say two things. So again, this idea of the model minority that you read about for today, in that chapter you read in yellow, Law Professor Frank Wu, he talks about kind of these assumptions about Asian Americans' relative economic success was partly, like, these assumptions are part of the reason why many people, you know, didn't even think Asian Americans needed any kind of civil rights movement, right? Like, if you're doing well financially, if, like, you're sending your kids to an Ivy League school, like, what do you need, right? Like, what are you still fighting for? Do you even have, like, a civil rights claim to make? And this is something I think, you know, is still kind of prevalent in some circles today in thinking about Asian Americans. And that's, you know, assuming people even think about Asian Americans. Because the other piece I would say is, you know, Asian Americans still make up about, I think, 6% of the country's population at this point. And there's a longer history there just about kind of their relative lack of voting power. And we can talk about that. But I mean, even with the model minority trope, and I hope that you picked up on this, both the New York Times piece and the yellow chapter that you read for today, what's really interesting to think about is the model minority, it is about Asian Americans, but if you actually read between the lines, it's ultimately not really about Asian Americans. And I think that's typically how you hear Asian Americans talked about, I would argue even today, right? With the affirmative action debate, for example, there was a case out of Harvard, right, where you had some conservative Chinese Americans actually fighting against affirmative action, arguing it discriminates against Asian Americans, although the majority of Asian Americans in this country do support affirmative action. So, I mean, even within that debate, right, there have been a lot of discussions about, like, why, like, who is using whom, right? It's kind of like Asian Americans, many have argued, were being used. They were being used as a tool to kind of dismantle affirmative action. And with the model minority trope, I think a lot of the critique is the trope isn't actually about Asian Americans. It's a way that some political leaders, social scientists in the 1960s, they tried to use a model minority to try as a critique of African Americans, right? So in some ways, the model minority is not even necessarily ultimately about Asian Americans. They're kind of this like tool that's used at various times. And so that, I think that's another reason why perhaps people don't know much about this history, because usually if it's talked about at all, it's talked about in relationship to other groups or other struggles or other issues that aren't even ultimately about Asian Americans. So part of my work is the attempt to redress that. So two things I'll talk about today, just very briefly, right? If you look at history, the assumption that, you know, Asian Americans haven't had to struggle for anything, right? That, I mean, that assumption, you know, obviously I'm not gonna say that that's true. The assumption is false. And I'm gonna talk briefly about what many would call two Asian American civil rights movements. The first I wrote a whole book about, you know, which Professor Marsh mentioned earlier, it's the movement to repeal Asian exclusion. And the second one, which I'll talk about more briefly, is the Asian American movement, which in many ways was an outgrowth of not just kind of civil rights, but Black power in particular in the late 1960s. So I'll talk briefly about these and we can always follow up with questions. So I'll just say, so Asian exclusion in the United States, most people have heard of Chinese exclusion. I think that if you learn anything about this history, this immigration history, that is the one law that you might've heard of. In 1882, you know, it bans or tries to bar Chinese workers from entering the United States. And the way that critical race theory, so the way that law professors, many scholars have talked about race in America. So if you think about civil rights, it's important to recognize how different groups in American history have battled different kinds of discrimination, right? So not all of their struggles for rights are going to look the same because their actual histories of discrimination are different. And so for African-Americans, right, you see second-class citizenship. So African-Americans, Black Americans have fought for the full promises of their citizenship, voting, for example. Latino-Americans, right, you see different kinds of struggles, particularly around migration and deportation struggles. I teach this in my U.S. immigration history. For Asian-Americans, the struggle has really been, so Asian-Americans have historically been racialized as foreign, right, and there are a lot of historians and law professors who write about why. And one of the arguments they make is that it's really because of these exclusion laws. Because before the 1960s, for much of American history, Asians were not allowed to immigrate to the United States in large numbers. And for large periods of time, Asians were not allowed to immigrate, period. So exclusion from immigration and also exclusion from US citizenship. Right. So until 1952, if you were a person of Asian descent born in another country, you could not naturalize. You were racially barred from naturalizing as a U.S. citizen. Right. So there's a whole bunch of laws, which I will not go deep into. Right. There's a lot of writing on this. But when you think about like what is Asian exclusion, first, I will say that Asian exclusion is not just a US thing. And some of the best work that's being done right now by scholars like Mei Nye at Columbia, there's all these immigration scholars working on this research. Asian exclusion is something that happens in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. I mean, it's actually a global story. It's a global history. But in the United States, I talk about it in the United States particularly. I do foreign policy. So we can talk more about that. But in the United States, it happens pretty early. Australia is also, you know, perfecting it pretty early on. But it happens in the United States, series of laws such that by the time you get to 1917, 1924, basically, if you are someone in Asia who wants to immigrate, it's extremely hard, right? And there's actually this map that Congress draws in 1917. It's called the Asiatic Barred Zone. And let me just tell you, when you think about the category of Asian American, kind of who we think of as Asian American today, I mean, the argument that scholars make that is, I think, just is the truth. That category itself, I mean, that was a category created by the law, right? So in 1917, did Indians think of themselves as having much in common with Chinese? Maybe in some places, but not really. Not really, right? So the term, like, the term back then was not Asian American, it was actually Asiatic, right? That was the term that the law used. And so May Nye has argued, historian May Nye, she basically says, the category Asiatic is a racial category created by exclusion. Just like Latino, for example, is a category that was created by the US Census. And there's a lot of writing about, right, those kind of racial categories. So basically, because Asian Americans were historically excluded from immigration and US citizenship, really their civil rights struggles began with the fight to first enter the United States, right, to get in as immigrants, and once here, to fight for US citizenship, the right to naturalize. And so by 1924, essentially what you see here, there's a complete ban on it, Asian immigration and Asian naturalization as US citizens. I mean, in my book, I spend a lot of time, I mean, basically my book looks at different campaigns that ended exclusion. And really what you see here, it's a bunch of different groups waging different campaigns that kind of borrowed from each other, but that were largely independent. And that really, that changes just a little bit near the end, but from basically between the 1940s and the 1960s, Chinese Americans, Indian Americans, Filipino Americans, Japanese Americans, and later Chinese Americans again, there are these kind of community campaigns where you have folks like here on the left, Mike Masayoka of the Japanese American Citizens League. He wasn't very popular because he actually cooperated with the US government during the incarceration of Japanese Americans. So there's also a lot of very conservative groups who are spearheading a lot of this activism to end Asian exclusion, right? So this isn't necessarily a very radical campaign, right? And what they were fighting for in most cases is just very small quotas, right? So China, they had zero people allowed to enter before 1943. In 1943, the Chinese American community, they're not even that involved, to be honest. In the Chinese campaign case, it's actually people like Pearl Buck, the writer, and other missionary-connected Americans, other white American elites who have an interest in China. They're the ones who really spearhead that first campaign, right? So every one of these campaigns is quite different. But generally speaking, these are campaigns for very small gains. They're just asking for like quotas of 100. Can you allow in 105 Chinese per year? Right, which effectively is kind of like exclusion if you're asking, you know, if you think about the actual numbers, right? 100 people per year, it's largely symbolic. So a lot of these campaigns were fighting for symbolic change, right? But the idea was exclusion laws, they make America look racist, okay? They make America look racist. And also they really insult Asian powers. The Chinese government hated exclusion, right? For decades, Chinese officials basically were lobbying Washington to repeal Chinese exclusion from the 1880s all the way until the 1940s. For six decades, Chinese officials were like, hey, this is incredibly insulting for you to say, for America to say that Chinese are not good enough, right, to admit to your country, not good enough for US citizenship. And so after these many decades of kind of lobbying and activism by Asian governments and also by Asian immigrants in the United States and their white allies, after many, many decades, why does it finally work in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s? It's because of US interests in Asia, right? It's really about US power and US empire building. And I can talk a little bit more about that. I mean, in the case of the Chinese, it's because the United States allies with China, right, during World War II to fight Japan. With the Japanese Americans, right, there's this whole movement that follows World War II, where many white elites like Earl Warren, former governor of California, they feel really bad about incarceration. Oh, that was terrible, incarceration. So, right, so what happens is groups like the JACL, right, they kind of play on this regret to get very incremental, kind of more symbolic legislation passed, right, to get citizenship eligibility and then immigration quotas for Asian countries. But it goes bit by bit, right? So, you know, it's very hard to get these laws through Congress. It's extremely hard, right? And a lot of what I kind of chart in my book is I'm looking at these legislative campaigns. And I'm primarily interested, I look a lot at Asian Americans, but Asian Americans, most of them couldn't even vote, right? And there were very few Asian Americans, like they're not a huge electoral block. So it's not like they could lobby Congress and say, I'm not gonna vote for you if you don't pass this bill. So they had to use very creative kind of non-electoral ways to get people's attention, to get Congress on board. And one of the ways they did that, so here I just mentioned Japanese Americans on the left, on the right, this is the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. Again, a very kind of respectability politics, kind of conservative group based in California that was very instrumental in fighting for Chinese Americans. In my work, I think one of my major contributions is that I pay a lot of attention to the groups that many kind of scholars who study Asian immigration don't really pay as much attention to, because they're much smaller groups and they have a more complicated history. In particular, I look at Indians and Filipinos. And I think Professor Marsh mentioned earlier, I do research in both of these countries, because what I was really interested in is thinking about how Filipinos and Indians in the United States, they actually partner with Philippine and Indian government officials in Asia. And they actually partner together to lobby Congress, to lobby people in Washington, D.C. And so you see all these kind of Philippine government officials, Indian government officials kind of circulating through Congress. They testify at congressional hearings. They do a lot of backroom dealings as well, because, you know, they don't want to make it look like foreign governments are interfering in U.S. In U.S. politics. So there's a lot of kind of behind the scenes lobbying that I do a lot of excavating of. And I found all of these records basically in the Indian and Philippine National Archives, because these governments cared a lot about what the United States was doing. And even that itself is really interesting to note, right? Why do Indians in 1945, 46 care about what the United States is doing? Because the fact is they care a lot. And what it comes down to, I tie this story to kind of, an Asian American kind of civil rights kind of struggles in the United States. I tie it to anti-colonial movements in Asia, because the reason why Indian and Philippine officials care about what's happening in the United States is because this is the very moment that India and the Philippines were fighting for independence, right? And they both have different stories. The Philippines, of course, was a U.S. colony, right? So this is not like a, right? This is not like an off there kind of story. This is like a very kind of internal U.S. struggle as well. The United States grants the Philippines independence in 1946, but there's a lot of negotiation that leads up to that. And so Philippine government officials, they're basically like, how are we going to ensure the future of the Philippines after the United States leaves, after we become independent, right? And for them, Philippine officials are actually really interested in getting the support of Filipinos in the United States. And it's a really interesting story, right? I mean, so these stories are really, what I kind of uncovered was these Asian officials were really involved in these immigration campaigns in the United States for their own purposes, right? So they were using the repeal campaigns as instrumental, kind of as part of their own state and nation building projects. So for Philippine officials, it was about ensuring the financial future of the Philippines, because the Philippines, even now, it depends very heavily on what's called remittances. It's money that are sent back from overseas workers, okay, overseas Filipinos. This is true today, and this was actually still true in the 1940s, right? The Philippine government was incredibly interested in making sure that Filipino Americans continue to send money back to the Philippines so that the Philippines could rebuild after the war. So there's all these different conversations happening. In India, a lot of it had to do with the Indian government wanting the United States to support Indian independence, because India had a really hard time getting independence from Great Britain. So there's a whole story there that I talk in great depth about. But it really comes down to kind of this intersection between Asian decolonization, Asian anti-colonial movements, and Asian American civil rights, right? In ways that I think people are beginning to uncover, but that really haven't been talked about a lot before. And ultimately, the argument I make that Professor Marsh outlined earlier is, you know, I basically argue that repeal is essentially America's effort to increase support and to kind of support U.S. power and empire building projects in Asia. And the final thing I'll say is, because if you don't know, the United States was all over Asia after World War II, right? The United States occupied Southern Korea, it occupied Japan, it relinquished the Philippines, but then basically controlled their economy for many decades. Many would argue they still control too much of it even today. The United States had troops stationed across Southeast Asia. The United States was also involved secondarily in India, but they were still involved in that whole process as well. I mean, so the United States is incredibly invested in Asia. And basically, repeal is the United States' way of getting at least tacit support, acquiescence, whatever it is, cooperation for its own empire building projects in Asia, right? So that's the book, but the movement itself, right? You have complete repeal by 1965. And I could talk more about this. This is actually, right, this by itself, right? Repeal happens in 65, but a lot of it wasn't unintentional. We could talk more about that. But this is the law that really transforms who enters the United States. And I think some of you might have seen kind of, there's been a lot of talk about kind of immigration policy and kind of who is allowed in, how do people get in through family relationships and others, right? This is still the law that governs, this is still the basis of most immigration policy today, the 1965 Immigration Act. We could talk more about that if you have questions. But that's the first kind of, right, that's the first civil rights battle. And I'll talk very briefly about the second one because I do want to leave time for us to have a conversation together. And the second, right, is the Asian American movement. And this one I think is lesser known. I mean, some of you might have heard of this kind of maybe. It's sometimes taught in comparative civil rights movement classes. It's taught in Asian American studies classes. But I'm from the East Coast and the schools where I went to, Asian American studies is not really that developed. I live in California now, so it's like night and day. Night and day, right? So I learned so much from moving out here. I'm from New Jersey, so I am a consummate East Coast person. So when I moved out here, I was like, Asian American studies departments, I don't understand, right? So it's a different academic scene out here. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that there was an Asian American movement, right? This is actually directly ties back to this movement. So the Asian American movement, it's kind of most active in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And it grows out of Black power, as I mentioned before, and also anti-war protests, right? Anti-Vietnam War protests. Because many Asian Americans, not just Vietnamese, because there weren't that many Vietnamese in the country at this point, but many Asian Americans during this time felt some racial solidarity with Vietnamese in Vietnam. And so we can talk more about that. But for Asian American movement activists, they weren't just satisfied with kind of inclusion, kind of civil rights, right? In the way that had been talked about till then. They really wanted kind of self-determination. And it wasn't just for Asian Americans, right, in the United States, but for Asian peoples in Asia. And so they very much tied, right? There's a lot of kind of third world solidarity becomes one of the frameworks for this movement. And the Asian American movement, largely Chinese and Japanese American, because that's primarily who was here, right, at that point. Japanese Americans were the largest population. It was active on both the East and the West Coast, but West Coast had a much larger population. Right here, it's all kinds of images I can show here, but here you kind of have one image, right? East Coast and West Coast. So you had Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, some Koreans, some South Asians, some Filipino Americans, and that was largely, right, a lot of it. On the East Coast, you had groups like Asian Americans for Action. Yuri Kochiyama is probably one of the best known members of this group. It's formed in New York City in 1969. Yuri Kochiyama, right? She's oftentimes known as the woman who's cradling Malcolm X's head when he was assassinated in 1965. She was part of a Nisei Progressives group, a Japanese American group that was active in New York, and that was fighting for rights for Asian Americans. On the right, probably the best known person among some of the groups in California, this is Richard Aoki. He was field marshal of the Black Panther Party before he helped found APA, the Asian American Political Alliance, in 1968. There are groups called the Red Guard Party in San Francisco, Chinatown, which was modeled after kind of the Black Panther Party, but also takes some inspiration from Mao. So these groups weren't just interested, right? They weren't just interested in kind of more traditional civil rights, as I mentioned. For them, they really cared about critiquing capitalism. They cared about organizing workers. In places like Chinatown, San Francisco, they really railed against US imperialism. And so for many of the folks who were involved with anti-war protests, they saw Vietnam as a very clear example of US meddling and imperialism in Asia. And so that kind of fueled a lot of the anti-war protest. And they were interested in social services. And finally, as I mentioned before, right, they were really interested in institutional change at universities. And so the reason Asian American studies exists in places like UCLA, San Francisco State University, UC Berkeley, the UCs generally, and also a lot of California universities, is because Asian Americans fought alongside Latino Americans, African Americans, and others in what's called the Third World Liberation Front, right? And this was actually a whole movement. I was gonna show a video, but I think for the sake of time, I won't. But basically you had activists from these different groups coming together in a coalition, and they put pressure on San Francisco State University and later UC Berkeley to create ethnic studies, right? Classes where these groups, community groups, could actually learn about their own histories. Because a lot of what these activists talked about were, you know, they'd never learned about anything about their own history in the classroom. And, right, to think about kind of what that means for a community to not have a history, right, that was part of the push for ethnic studies. And again, this is something that, you know, has really borne a lot of fruit, right, in the sense that anytime you see an ethnic studies class or department at a university, that is a direct outgrowth of the Third World Liberation Front and the ethnic studies strikes of the late 1960s, like in very real concrete form. You could take classes in these departments. There are people hired in these classes. And I think that's something important to think about. The final thing I'll say with the Asian American movement, I mean, the biggest achievements apart from creating ethnic studies and Asian American studies, one big one is it creates the category Asian American, right? And I think if any of you know the term Chicano, Chicana, that term itself is inherently political. And that also came out of the same moment, the late 1960s, the Chicana movement. So Asian American, that term was actually created in a very similar way to be inherently politicized, right? The idea that you would call yourself not Chinese American, not Japanese American, but Asian American, that you would claim kind of a racial solidarity or racial identity, that itself was seen as a political act in the 1960s. So the fact that we use that term so liberally today is interesting to think about, right? But it really is an outgrowth of what the 68 Asian American movement accomplished. And the final thing is the Asian American movement was very coalitional. So the idea that Asian Americans should fight alongside Latino Americans, African Americans, Native Americans, and others, that very idea of coalitional politics, multiracial politics, was very much a legacy of the Asian American movement and the late 1960s in general. And so I'm happy to talk more about that. I'm sure you've talked much about this in the course, thinking about kind of how the different groups interact because they're living in many of the same places, right? San Francisco has a lot of people, not just Asian Americans, not just white Americans, but many others. And so thinking about kind of how these groups crossed paths and what that meant for cooperation, potentially conflict, right? I'd be interested to talk about those too, if you have questions, but I'll stop there and invite any questions that folks may have.
That was fantastic. Thank you so much, Jane. Applause, applause. So yes, I know there are questions and comments. Yeah, I love the hands. Who wants to get it going?
Actually, one thing I would just ask is how many people have, I mean, how many of, you know, among you all, among students, I mean, how many have actually heard any of this history before? So either kind of repeal, thinking about Asian exclusion and the repeal or the Asian American movement. I'm always curious kind of to see who has heard what before. So I think I saw one hand. I see Karen. Okay. Karen, what have you heard before? I don't know. Can you unmute yourself?
I think Roxanne, do you have your hand up?
Oh, did you? Okay. So two.
Oh. I can speak a little bit. I actually spent the summer reading a lot more about Asian American history. I don't know, just like something about being in quarantine. I had an English teacher from my high school send me a lot of like books written by Asian American women. And it was like, I think the first time I really like encountered that sort of literature, and then that kind of like led me down a path. I also read like Racial Capital by Oka Day over the summer, which was a really interesting read and like covers a lot. It's about Canadian, Asian Canadian history, but I think a lot of it was applicable also to the US.
You called on me, professor. Yeah, this is Karen. I think I was more familiar with the literature kind of Asian Americans. in college and in grad school. And since then, I've read a lot of fiction in particular. So I learned about the experience this way. I did learn about Mary Pike Lee, Korean American woman. And I can't remember how I found her, but I think I was asking for some of these stories and read her book. And that sort of unlocked sort of an area of scholarship that I hadn't seen before. But no, I feel like a lot of this was new to me.
No, I appreciate that. No, Mary Pakeley, I mean, I've been immersed in her work because I'm writing that piece about her.
You're so great.
So Jane is writing a chapter on Mary Pakeley for our new book collaboration. We did this, Jane and 12 or 13 other scholars are involved in this project of putting a book together called People Get Ready. And it's sort of a project that tries to retrieve sort of progressive religious voices in American history and give them kind of a fresh introduction. There is a lovely narrative of Yuri Kujiyama here in this volume that Grace
Cow, I think.
Yeah, Grace. Why am I seeing you here? Oh, that's because the index does not include. Yeah, which I'm really happy to make available as a resource. May I just ask a quick question? In what sense was Yuri working in, self-consciously, kind of the yellow power movement? And yellow power is, such a beautiful, arresting, compelling term. And correct me if I'm wrong, but there's little attention, scholarly attention to the movement. And I would have at least expected one or, trade book, Simon Schuster, Knopf, FSG or something on yellow power. And I could not find one.
Yeah, I feel like the Frank Wu book that you excerpted from, The Yellow from 2002, is kind of one of the main trade books I could think of. I mean, there might be something I'm missing, but no. I mean, even among scholars, there are a few scholars like Diane Fugino at UCSB, Daryl Maeda at University of Colorado, who write about the Asian American movement and Asian kind of yellow power, but and radicalism generally. But it is something that I think more folks need to write about. That's the thing that's really interesting about Asian American topics. I mean, I think, I've been writing, I've been a professor for 7 years, much shorter than Professor Marsh and others. It's interesting to think about kind of how different groups become legible, right? Like, for example, how many articles did you read about Latino Americans before, if you're not Latino American, if you're not taking a course, for example? How many articles did you see in the mainstream media before the election season this year? Like, kind of when do you see that attention all of a sudden crop up, right? When do people become legible, right? And I think usually it's in the context of like politics, right? Electoral politics, like who matters, what demographics matter, who does what party need to go after? Right. And that goes for both, I guess, both parties. Who do they need to go after? But the Asian American history, I mean, I would argue you really get, it's essentially, this history of, for example, Asian exclusion repeal. I mean, that's still about the U.S. state. It's still about U.S. immigration policy. It's still about Congress. It's just a different way of looking at the same topic, right, that many folks, many historians might write about. But the legibility question is something I really think a lot about, and kind of which groups get written about, which ones don't, like who matters and who doesn't when it comes to the books, the articles, the media coverage. And what metrics are used to determine that, right? It's not always numbers. It could be numbers, right? Oh, there's so many of you, let's write about you. For example, Hmong Americans, who, as I mentioned before, honestly, I didn't know much about Hmong Americans before college, before I took an Asian American history class. I don't think I really heard about that group. I mean, I went, as Professor Marsh mentioned, I went to Yale. So, you know, East Coast, New Jersey, Connecticut, right? I mean, I knew what Asian Americans were, I thought, but they were mostly East Asian where I was from. But learning about Hmong Americans, I learned about them in college. But in the last like few weeks, couple months, I've seen a lot more news pieces in kind of mainstream media outlets about Hmong Americans. Why? Because they're a voting bloc in Wisconsin, right? Which was a swing state in this election. And so I think a lot about that legibility question. And I think that kind of, that's essentially what you're asking, right, Charles? It's kind of like, when do people pay attention to these topics? What publishers decide to actually publish in these topics? Because based on what will, they think will sell. Yeah, so it's a good question to think about.
And can I just chime in a little to answer your question earlier about like when we have ever heard or had articles about like Asian Americans or the history. I wanted to say this earlier, but I didn't get a chance. But in my queer theory class with Andre Calavante, we had some units like about Asian American history and about how like their experiences in the queer community was one of the only other classes that really actually gave like attention to like a specific group. For me, at least.
Oh, no, that's, thanks for that. No, I can see that. I mean, I'm writing, like my new project has a whole, I have a chapter on, I look at gay rights struggles. I look at same-sex marriage in California and Asian American evangelicals' role in those campaigns. And it's been a whole kind of, there's a whole literature, I think, in queer studies, LGBTQ studies, right, where it's really interesting that those scholars in those fields, whether or not they're Asian, of Asian origin themselves, they pay more attention, right? Maybe it's kind of the value or the value that they give to liminality, to liminal groups. But yeah, it's been a whole eye-opening experience for me.
Other students, I know you're wowed by this luminary, but I also know you have great questions. So,
well, I had a question for, I know Roxanne, you raised your hand earlier, right? When I think I asked about kind of folks who had heard any of these topics before, I'm just curious, where have you encountered these histories?
Well, recently I read an article, it's kind of old, it's like a couple of years old, from the New Yorker about the guy who immigrated from Afghanistan to Wyoming, I think around like the turn of the century, like 1900. And it's talking about him, like how he wasn't always designated as Asian, like as, I don't know, how he was designated racially when he was trying to immigrate, and it sort of addressed those laws.
That's really interesting, because I think you're right. There's a whole history about kind of citizenship cases where you had, right, where kind of racial categories get really tricky, right? You have like an Indian man in the 1920s saying, you should give me citizenship because I'm white, right? Aryans, Indians are Aryan, they're white, da, 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 right? So there's a lot of kind of, he's not successful, obviously. And then there are also cases with Syrians, Armenians, right? Who basically tried to claim whiteness. Because before the 1950s, the only people who could naturalize as US citizens were free white persons or persons of African descent. And I think maybe by 1924, also indigenous, so Native Americans as well. So there are really particular categories. So a lot of people tried to claim whiteness. And I think that's probably one of the cases that you're talking about. That's really interesting.
Okay, who else? Ben.
I'd be interested to hear you talk more about kind of changing self-identification within Asian American, whether that's East Asian or South Asian. My cousins are half Indian, and increasingly, especially kind of in solidarity with police violence movements, they are talking about themselves as brown, like they grew up brown, and how that kind of places them maybe in a different category than Asian, not to push themselves away, but just to kind of emphasize what being brown in this country is. So any thoughts you had on that?
No, I think that's a great question. And that's such an important conversation that's been happening. I mean, before 9/11, right, obviously before 9/11, but particularly after 9/11, thinking about groups that for the purposes of racial categories would be considered Asian, who just had vastly different experiences in the post 9/11 regime, right, where you had South Asians. You had six, for example, being targeted because people were mistaking them for Muslim, even though they're literally Sikh, right? Which is a different religious tradition. Even people coming to grips with the fact that Indonesia is actually, right, the largest Muslim country on earth. It's actually an Asian country, not, right, a country that people typically think about. And the experiences, right, of kind of South Asians, some Southeast Asians, folks. And it's raised a lot of questions about kind of colorism within the community as well. I think you're exactly right. And that's something, I mean, I think a lot about that. I mean, I mentioned earlier the whole debate or kind of question and conversation around Kamala Harris and who can claim her. But I think it goes, I mean, it goes way beyond that to kind of to what extent. I mean, it ties back to a lot of the issues I raised earlier. It's like when you think about solidarity within the community, like to what extent do people like your cousins like see themselves as having much in common with like a, you know, fourth generation Chinese American? You know what I mean? It's and even among Chinese Americans, oh my goodness, there's right, there's Taiwanese Americans, Hong Kong Americans, right? So I am Korean American, but my friends who have like Cantonese roots with the Hong Kong protests, right? Such Chinese America is like one of also incredibly internally diverse in ways that I think most people don't understand. Same thing with South Asians, right? It's like, I talk about Indians in my work because in 1940, it was just India, which is a British colony. But today, right, you have India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, right? All of these countries, they're South Asian, but they also have these different religious traditions. So even amongst themselves, right, this category that we impose on them, and who do I mean by we? I guess I just mean like US shorthand parlance, right? We, South Asians themselves are an incredibly, even internally, diverse category. I think what the Asian American movement tried to do, right, was to kind of rally together, right, these groups in solidarity based on the argument that they had something in common, right, that they had common interests to fight for. And I think there are still, right, there are still groups like Asian Americans Advancing Justice. I did phone banking with them like in the last 2 weeks before the election. And I did phone banking with the Democratic Party of Pennsylvania. And I was incredibly with the AAPI group. And I was just really moved because, I mean, it was like East Asian Americans, South Asian Americans, Southeast Asian Americans. And they all were coming together under that kind of racial umbrella of AAPI. The PI, the whole other story we could talk about too, Pacific Islander. So I saw that solidarity there, right, during particular moments. In terms of whether that solidarity is lasting or whether it even should be lasting, you know, so should it be like coalitions for particular causes, like the election? Should it be long-term solidarities? Like what humps do you need to kind of get over? Filipino Twitter is extremely active on these questions with Filipino Americans, right? Many times Filipino Americans argue that they're not really included when people talk about Asian Americans. And so there's a whole conversation around that too. So there's like an internal conversation, you know, which I think your cousins might be part of. There's also the kind of broader conversation. But as I said, I have seen moments where that solidarity really, I've seen it in practice even today. So that's something I find very encouraging. It's elusive, but there are moments.
Order, yeah.
Okay, so this class, we've been focusing on the religious and theological influences in the civil rights movement. I'm curious as to the role of religion in the Asian American movement in the 60s and how that played out in the formation of this movement.
That is a great question. That ties directly to chapter one of my second book, where I'm basically writing this whole piece about... basically, I'm looking at how churches, both mainline, so Protestant mainline and evangelical churches in places like Chinatown, San Francisco, Berkeley, California, and you had all these clergy, and from different traditions who were really active and central in the Asian American movement. But that part doesn't really get talked about a lot. And I think this is part of the reason why I wanted to include those stories in my second book. It's that there is like this really, you all might have talked about this during the course, but there's still kind of this strange divide sometimes between kind of what folks call like religious history. So like when you talk about churches and when you talk about religious people, and then like activism history, it might not be, it's, I don't think that division is as clear cut. And, you know, when you talk about Black civil rights, for example, but for Asian American activism, the scholarship that does exist, there's almost no attention to the fact that, you know, religious actors and like clergy actually play a huge role in this early activism. So I've interviewed like 10 or so, 15, right? Like clergy and clergy adjacent people, right, who were involved in this early activism and who actually saw their activism as, you know, part of their Christian witness to the larger community. It's like, why did they care about Chinese Americans getting social services in Chinatown, San Francisco, like really struggling, elderly, poor Chinese Americans? Why do they care? They cared because they believed that the church and that, you know, Jesus cared. So, I mean, they really did see their activism as an outgrowth of their faith. But I mean, that's something, again, that I think hasn't really been talked about as much, but I'm hoping to really kind of bring that out, foreground that in my work. That's a great question. Oh, Karen?
This is kind of a follow-up question to Porter's question, but in your study of Asian American like evangelicism or like just mainland Christianity in America, do you see that it's common for Asian Americans to integrate like Asian religious traditions into their practice in America, or does it feel more of like a rejection and distancing of those Asian practices as almost like a form of assimilation? Not to like generalize about Asian American religious experiences.
No, that's a tricky question. It's a good one. I think a lot of folks in religious studies have written about this, or not a lot, but some folks, actually probably a lot that I just don't know about, but I've read some of it. I mean, I think a good example is when I think about Asian immigrants. So many of the folks I write about, I'm writing about second and third generation. So people like me who were born here, for example, but I care also a lot. I write a lot about the Asian immigrants, right? Who many of them were actually converted before they came to the United States. And that has a lot to do with the fact that like American evangelical organizations like the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, Campus Crusade for Christ, they were huge. World Vision, they were huge, particularly in East Asia. They were huge. I have a colleague at Emory who's writing a whole book on kind of the connections between South Korean evangelicalism and U.S. evangelicalism. So Billy Graham goes to South Korea in like the 1950s or 1960s. I mean, it's one of the biggest kind of crusades that he leads internationally. So, I mean, so it gets tricky to answer that question because I think the kind of lines between kind of U.S. evangelicalism and kind of Asian, right, Asian variations or kind of how evangelical Christianity in particular is practiced in Asia, the lines are kind of blurry because a lot of times it's the same organizations, right, that themselves are global in scope. But an example I can think of is, I know ancestor worship, right? Ancestor worship is something that I know in particularly in Korea was something that Presbyterian missionaries like Samuel Moffat, the Underwoods, I think they were Presbyterian and Methodist who came in the late 19th century, early 20th century. You know, I think there was a whole debate, and this happens in many countries across the world. This is not just a Korean case, but you have these American missionaries who are like, oh, is ancestor worship, you know, is that like anti-Christian? Is that like satanic? Is that like biblical, right? And that debate looks different in different places. But I think for many of these early American missionaries, it was something they heavily discouraged. And I mean, even in my own family, some family members became Christian in Korea through Campus Crusade for Christ, Korea. and, you know, I have uncles who are pastors now living in New York who are just like, no, you can't do that. That's very unbiblical. It's very unchristian. And those are things that they learned. I think this uncle in particular learned during his time in Korea, right? Which is something that people still talk about even within immigrant communities in the United States. Like what kind of Korean or Asian traditions are acceptable, you know, which ones fit with the Bible, which ones don't. There's still a lot of debate, I think, even now, even within families. Like my family still fights about that. Right? Can you pay respect to your ancestor on the day that they died every year? Is that biblical? Can real Christians do that? Like people still talk about that, believe it or not, within immigrant communities.
Sorry, this is just really interesting. But is that, do you see that debate as largely functioning under like a biblical framework or operating under almost like a white hegemonic framework, or honestly both?
Yeah, that's where it gets really tricky, right? And this is what I'm trying to tease out in my work, kind of how to think about people's beliefs and how to respect them without trying to label them in disrespectful ways. You know, when I think about, like, it really matters to me how people like my uncle understand their own religious practice. Like I want to respect that without being like, it's assimilationist, right? Missionaries of the devil, right? It's trying to kind of, so my effort to try to be respectful is, it takes the form of me trying to like really tease out and to really take seriously people's beliefs. And of course, as a scholar, I need to figure out like, where did the debate happen? Where did it come from? What are people saying? So even just constructing that conversation that many people don't even know about, that's part of the story too. Just kind of bringing that into the conversation, like, oh, these are things people care deeply about and that's people still care deeply about. So no, it's something I struggle with in my work for sure. It's a good question.
Others, we have a few minutes. 5 or 8 minutes.
I'm standing between you all and dinner, so.
No, you're not. No, this is just so rich and helpful. May I ask a quick question?
Of course.
There's an interesting story that former director of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture, Charles Reagan Wilson, at the University of Mississippi tells, and the center there has done some work on Asian Americans, primarily Chinese Americans in the Mississippi Delta. They're the first, community of Chinese Americans arrived in the Delta during Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And some were working initially as sharecroppers, and then, in time, many began to run the stores, the small little markets that primarily served African American communities, but otherwise, that's a fairly kind of unstudied story as the Chinese American community grows in the Delta, so that by 1960 there are several thousand Chinese Americans, and then there are, I think, 15 or 16 Asian Americans in Mississippi. But that's kind of just there, and he follows the story of this one man, this Chinese man who actually first, arrived in California, but he was working on the railroad system, and he ended up in a small Delta town, Mississippi Delta town. I think it was like 1870, and married a Black woman. And, the story of their family and kind of carving out this kind of strange little singular tri-ethnic kind of niche that survived for a while, and until the Klan and the Knight Riders began to bring Reconstruction down. And gosh, just what an incredible story that would be to write, to follow. And all right, so anyway, that aside, I just two questions. So, staying in the Southern Theater, can you just make a couple of general comments about, what you know of Asian American participation in the movement You know, so, you know, 64 when students are recruited and, you know, 1,000 or so during Freedom Summer. And then there's kind of a recruitment effort that's maintained with American universities, you know, primarily, you know, Northeast and kind of the progressive enclaves in Madison and Ann Arbor, but there are quite a number from the West Coast as well. So Asian American participation in the civil rights movement in the South. Sorry, this is, I just want to talk to you so much for that. But also like Asian American perception of the civil rights movement in the South. And then kind of the third part of that is, I'm sorry, it's such a convoluted question. The first kind of signs of the civil rights movement in the South, you know, say 1955 to 1964, which is how I kind of like to mark one chapter of the story, its influence on Asian American kind of social activism and identity. So is that too much to ask?
No. I just hope I can do justice to your question in a short time, because I want to make sure I respect everyone's time too. No, these are great questions. And in fact, when I teach Reconstruction in my U.S. History Survey, I assign a whole chapter from a book called Coolies and Cane, which is about when former slaveholders try to bring in Chinese immigrants to replace formerly enslaved peoples, because they're like freaking out about who's going to do the work. So they bring in a bunch of Chinese. They're like, oh, these people are docile. But then the docile people end up like striking, and then they eventually get kicked out, right? So they were like, many former slaveholders thought Chinese were like the answer, so they imported them from Cuba and other places in the Caribbean. So very interesting. So yeah, there's a long history, you're right, of like there's a real long interesting history of kind of Asians in the South that goes back even right to the 19th century. But by the time, so I was reminded about a documentary that I have seen about Chinese Americans in the Delta. So this is a different story. There was no intermarriage in this story, but I think it was a family separated by Chinese exclusion. So very briefly, Asian Americans in the Southern Civil Rights Movement. I mean, whenever I just read stories, it's always like individuals who participated in like Freedom Summer, right? There's like very like, there's individual stories that I've seen usually in like random news media. There's like individual stories. So it's oftentimes, so I don't know how much work there's been done. I do know that like Asian Americans in California, like the Japanese American Citizens League sent several hundred people to attend the March on Washington in 1963. So there were definitely Asian Americans, typically East Asian Americans, involved in kind of these big moments. But not in large enough numbers, and or else people haven't written about them, right? So they haven't really been documented, so we don't know as much. But I know that like groups have sent delegations to these kind of large events. In terms of views of Black civil rights, I write about this in my book. I mean, there is so much that can be said, but I think the two things are, first, I mean, I think, you know, similar to just general views of the civil rights movement, you know, I think many kind of more second or kind of more professionally established Asian Americans, kind of the older folks, elites, were very skeptical of the civil rights movement. They still kind of supported it to some extent, but I think the views were mixed. And the second thing I'll say there very briefly is just where this becomes an issue is when Hawaii becomes a state and starts sending Asian Americans to Congress. And those Asian American Congress people are supposed to vote on the Civil Rights Act and other pieces of civil rights legislation. And that kind of creates a whole conversation about like Asian Americans and African Americans, what relationship do they have? It's quite contentious in like the early 1960s. And the last thing I'll say is, in terms of the longer term influence, I mean, apart from these documentaries I see about like individual Chinese American families in the Delta and things, I don't see a lot, but there is a book, Stephanie Hinerschütz has written a whole book about Asian American civil rights struggles in the South. So I can send you that title for sure. That just came out within the last 2 years.
Is this the book called A Different Shade of Justice?
Yes, I haven't read it yet.
That looks terrific, yeah. I haven't read it either, Asian American Civil Rights in the South, but I'm eager to. So you, who do you know, Stephanie Hinerschütz?
Yes. Hinerschütz.
Mm-hmm. On the first part, these individual stories, these individual characters that have come to your attention over the years, participants in the South? Do you have a list or have those?
I can look for one. I know. I feel like someone should have compiled something. I'll look around. I personally don't have one, but I imagine somebody somewhere might. So let me ask around. It's a good question.
You know, even the 12 or 14, you know, even the short article on that would be breaking ground.
True.
I mean, it would be part of, you know, yeah.
I agree.
Wow. Hey, I mean, this has just been so terrific. We are exceedingly grateful to you, Jane, for your time and your insights and for just the important work you do as a scholar and a citizen scholar. We're inspired by your visit and look forward to diving into some of your work. But you've really helped us in this task of kind of thinking of the civil rights movement in a more national and even global context. So here.
Claps. Thank all you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Enjoy the rest of the beautiful, well, it's, what is it? Almost 3 o'clock there. And love to your your husband and your beautiful daughter, baby daughter.
Thank you. I'm glad you didn't hear her crying in the background. So excellent. It's a win in my book.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you again.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Take care.
You too. Hey, you guys just hang for a second. That was fabulous. No? Wow.
Really nice.
I know.
Smart. She's very smart.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Yeah. And what one of the projects she's interested in doing after this new book, which I'm just terribly excited about, and I think we're going to try to form a kind of a national or a work group around her research, is a global history of the American civil rights movement, sort of looking at the civil rights movement in the context of its global sources and you know, repercussions. There's so much exciting work to be done in this area. So if you have any questions, you know, fire them my way. You have my cell phone. Isaac's going to give us a modest reading assignment for next week. We don't have any more logistical things to cover, do we? See, I'm just putting this off because I hate that part of the class where you say bye and then you all just disappear. And I'm here alone in a blooming sadness, you know, this kind of ambient melancholy that just kind of, and I'm just staring into the, anyway. Thanks again. And Malik, you want to hang on for a second? We can chat. See y'all. Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.